Shelley effect.
I'm a big fan of the show.
Chuck O'Shelley, and he's been known for many years as a blind JFK researcher specializing in intelligence agency involvement in multiple assassination, propaganda, and other global criminal operations in the 20th and 21st centuries.
Your listeners are extremely fortunate to have you.
And now the most underrated voice in all media.
Chuck O'Shelley!
Fifth day of September, allegedly, according to that thing we call a calendar, and this, indeed, is the O'Shelley Effect, broadcast live from the facilities of O'Shelley.com, but also heard on a variety of other networks and through a variety of facilities, including the podcast, which is distributed ever after in a whole lot of different places, you know, through your Fondle Slab of choice, your applicable application, your podcatcher du jour, whatever it may be. You are equally welcome to the show, whether you're hearing it live or... Well, they used to say Memorex, but I doubt anybody knows what the hell that is anymore. Anyway, here we go. It is a Wednesday night, a Woden's Day, if you will. Yes, that is the root for why that day of the week is named that. But anyway, this is a show I am really looking forward to doing. Normally, we relegate the discussions of the historical relevance of the assassinations to Thursday nights or Thursday nights. You know the way I talk. Anyway, and this is what we do. And tomorrow night will be no exception. We're going to continue the JFK 101 series with Larry Hancock and Carmine Sabastano tomorrow night. And it'll be the Assassination Records Review Board Part 2. But this is Wednesday. I am excited, though, because I actually have somebody on the show. Now, you guys hear me talk about books all the time. And I've had many an author on the show, and I've said, look, this is interesting, or this is well-written, or this is worth a look, or here's where you can learn about the book, and I say these kinds of things all the time. I do not often say that this is a book that I own, appreciate, have owned, okay, recommend, especially when it comes to the JFK assassination. As I've stated many, many times, unfortunately, of the many hundreds of books that I've read, a whole lot of them are headaches where I really feel the authors owe me a bit of money toward my Excedrin bill because they were complete wastes of time. The author I have on tonight is not one of those people. He is somebody who has put together a book, which I'm going to tell you right now, if you're interested in the medical evidence on the Kennedy assassination, and you don't have this book on your shelf, the book is called In the Eye of History. And it's got a longer title. Check it out for yourself. I'm going to provide you guys links to the different places where you can get it, because there's now an updated version of it, which I haven't seen yet, but I can guarantee you is also quite worthy of having on that shelf. Matter of fact, you might want to replace the old one with the new one. There's actually a DVD that comes along with it, I'm told. Anyway, I'm looking forward to seeing it. It's definitely one of those books I want to see. He's also presenting at Lancer this year. And there's a lot of stuff that I'm going to try and get to with my guest, William Mattson Law. And, again, this is among the handful. You know, your limited bookshelf space, when I tell you that you want to have an honest academic understanding of a great many aspects of the case, Mr. Law's book belongs in that limited shelf space. And meanwhile, he's continued to write stuff, and I didn't even know about it until I got in touch with him. And thanks to Larry Hancock for making that happen, because, again, I've been a fan of this book probably since it was probably about a year after it was released. I think I found it. I think it was one of these things where I was discussing with Andy at the Last Hurrah bookstore that I wanted a little more of a detailed examination of individuals that were involved with the medical evidence. And I'm pretty sure that's who suggested the book to me in the first place. Anyway, Mr. Law, how are you doing tonight, first of all?
I'm good, Chuck. How are you?
You know, I've been in interesting days lately, sir, so let's not even devolve into my personal situation. I wanted to set this up so that I could explain to people that I don't really often tell people that, look, this is an essential piece of the puzzle. I really, and I told you this privately already, that your book is one of those things that absolutely, if you want a serious look at the case and you want to go ahead and buy yourself about, let's say, 20 books, because you're going to need to cover various aspects, I could give you 20 books, and William Mattson Law, a little bit of a tongue twister for me, William Law, I usually say, and I also reference your book often, but anyway, your book is among that 20 that I would tell you has to be on your bookcase if this is what you're doing. And I also would not suggest that you only get the electronic version, although, again, I'm going to provide you guys with links to that this book that I'm talking about and a new one and some other things I didn't even know about. Anyway, so really, I'm extremely happy to have you on, and I'm also looking forward to the fact that I'm going to be able to talk to you about a new piece of work, but I want to start off with talking about In the Eye of History here in the first hour, and trust me, although I'm talking very fast and talking a lot, I'm going to shut up because I want to hear from you. Let me begin by asking a question and let you roll on into whatever direction you want, because I want to focus on In the Eye of History to begin with. What is it that motivated you to focus on the medical evidence? Because In the Eye of History is a collection of interviews. This is one way to describe the book. There's more to it. But is a collection of interviews of people that were directly involved with the body in one way or another, the autopsy, you know, the transportation of the body, the burial of the body. Most shockingly, a private citizen who got the two FBI agents who were present during the autopsy to talk to him. You know, a whole bunch of individuals who had firsthand knowledge of the events that were post November 22nd, 1963, when President Kennedy was killed. And it is a remarkable collection. Now, some people would immediately say, well, Chuck, you know, William Law did this later on, and you always criticize that whole looking at it later on and interviewing people later on. I criticize it when people cherry pick, and also there's already available interviews that are more contemporaneous. Here's the interesting thing. Even the official attempts and everybody's attempts previously, in my estimation, fail to put together what you put together in this book. So that, along with perspective and the way you carefully did it, means that even though it is 30 years, in some cases 40 years, and much longer since the events, guess what? This is an extremely valuable insight into a great many of the individuals who are directly involved, as I said, with dealing with John F. Kennedy's body. What is it that drew you to the medical evidence and this subject matter to begin with?
Well, you know, even when I was a kid, a teenager, and they would show something, I would think to myself, you know, the medical people have got to know the answers to this, and someday some of those people are going to come forward, and then we'll really know. And then years went by, and I didn't give it a lot of thought except for the occasional special, you know, that would pop up on TV. And I was in a local bookstore, and I stumbled across a book that had the autopsy pictures in it. And something looked strange about it. I was shocked that the autopsy pictures were available. I hadn't delved into any of the controversy. You know, I accepted pretty much what I'd been told, that Lee Harvey Oswald from a building shot John F. Kennedy in a car as he was going through Dealey Plaza. I took this book home, and I read it, and it gripped my imagination so hard that I reread it, and I reread it again, and I reread it again. It got to the point where I started reading everything I could lay my hands on about the assassination.
Curiosity forces me to ask, is it, because given the time period, I would say that it's either a book by Robert Groden or David Lifton that that first contained the images, or at least some of the images.
Well, that's interesting. I was a teenager in 75 when Robert Groden showed the Zapruder film on Good Night America, and I remember being shocked and just mesmerized by what it showed. Later on, toward the latter part of the 80s, I picked up a book by a man named David Lifton called Best Evidence, and he dealt with you know, what happened to the body during the events of Dallas and Bethesda. Now, this gripped me so hard that I thought, you know, my immediate thought was, this stuff cannot be true. He was saying that, in effect, that after the president's body was taken from Dallas and it arrived at Bethesda Naval Hospital for the autopsy, that there was a pre-autopsy autopsy performed, and I thought, this is, you know, I can't believe this. But so what happened was I just decided to start calling people, and I did. And one of the first people I called was Bill Newman, who was closest to President Kennedy at the moment of the fatal headshot. I went to Dallas sometime after that for a conference, and I was talking to one of the people that was running the conference, and I was, you know, babbling about how, you know, the if you want to find answers to what happened to President Kennedy, then you needed to delve into the medical evidence, because that's where the answers were. And they asked me to go up on stage and talk about it, and I just didn't feel comfortable enough to do that. So my intention was to go to this conference and get my obsession with this case under control. I thought, I am going to go to this thing. I am going to meet people that have read these books, have written these books. I'm going to meet these people, and I'm going to put it on a shelf, and I'm going to forget about it. It was taking up way too much of my life. So I went there. I did that. I met those people. I read those books. And as you can see, I was quite successful, because 25, 26, 27 years later, here I am still at it. And I didn't manage to put it on a shelf. If anything, it made it worse. And a few months after that conference, I found myself sitting in the living room of Gerald Custer, the man who had taken the x-rays of President Kennedy's body.
And, you know, this is really interesting because, you know, given again the time period, you're talking about a bit of a rise in interest due to the 25th anniversary having come and gone in 1988.
Right.
David Lipton released the third edition, I believe, if memory serves me correctly, of Best Evidence around 88, 89. And that has to be the copy you picked up. And then, therefore, if you went to a conference right after that in Dallas, that would be the one of the ESC conferences.
This was quite a few years after. I don't think I attended. I attended a Lancer conference, and I think they'd been around for quite a while at that point.
Oh,
and they're the people that, you know, that asked me to talk about it. And I just didn't feel confident enough to get up on the stage and talk in front of people about my opinion. That has since changed. I've done it quite a lot over the years.
Gerald Custer is an interesting guy, too, and it's fascinating. I mean, if you wouldn't mind kind of explaining how it is you got to talk to him, because Custer, I spoke to Custer at one point also, but I found that he was kind of educated by a lot of the books he had read when I spoke to him. And I didn't, this is something I've been criticized for saying, is that, you know, Custer, I have trouble taking everything he said later at face value because of the level of interest he showed in the case and how he followed other authors' ideas about things. It seemed to me as though he was kind of contaminated in a way. And now I'm not saying this because, I mean, he's passed away now. I'm not saying this to disparage him. What I'm saying is that everybody's memory is available for revision, okay, as time goes on. And Custer, it seems to me, was very, very malleable when it came to being open to suggestion from various people that he interacted with. At the same time, though, he was fairly friendly and fairly open and decent with just about anybody who called him up randomly like me. So, you know, I found him to be a really nice guy, too. So I wonder if you wouldn't tell us about, you know, kind of like in brief how you met him and what your experience was like with him.
Well, like you, I tracked him down in Pennsylvania. I called him, and I had this idea that, you know, I just wanted to start talking to people that were in the autopsy room. And at first, my only thought was is maybe to make up some sort of video film. And I talked to him with my idea. He agreed to it. We made arrangements. I stayed at the home of Vincent Palomara, who has done several books on the Secret Service and their actions and inactions that day in Dallas in the Plaza. Lancer Publications put us together. And so he was there, and we filmed it, and it was a really exciting time. It was one of the first. It was the first face-to-face on-camera interview I'd done with anybody. Mm. And he seemed that he like he wanted to talk about this. He was very friendly. We showed up on a crisp evening. His wife, Marilyn, invited us into their house, and they were having dessert, and we sat down with them and got to know each other a little bit. Just, you know, I'd seen the Best Evidence video, and that was some years before, and I'm sitting there, and he'd aged, you know, a little bit, but quite affable, quite friendly. We went into a back room that he had. We set up the camera, and we just, I wanted it to be just kind of like a table talk. I didn't want to try to be too formal about it. I was new at this. And so that's what we did. We just sat down, turned the camera on, and over a couple of day period, just I was allowed to ask anything and everything I wanted to. Now, I think you're right about Gerald Custer. I think that his memories had been, for lack of a better word, contaminated. And you'll know why once you read his interview, because that whole interview is in the book. I really enjoyed it. At the same time, I found him frustrating. He told me he would tell me everything that, that he knew. And then he told me he was working on some sort of book with another guy. I believe it was Tom Wilson, if memory serves. So he kind of held back things. I had not seen anything of Custer besides his piece in the Best Evidence video, and he told me he held up an X-ray that he said he had taken, and he said they wanted this man dead, and they did a good job of it. It was the frontal X-ray, and it was a pretty dramatic statement. Well, later on, this was a couple months later, I was sent a copy of the Cron interview that he'd done with Sylvia Chase, where he seemed to say that this wasn't what he remembered, and you know he was going this area the head is gone, and it so it taught me a lesson to know as much as I possibly could about the person's story before I went in to do an interview. Mm-hmm. I called up Custer and said I need to come back and do another interview. But he said, I'm busy now. I can't. I'm starting a new job. And before that could happen, he passed away. Mm. So I never did get out there to do another interview with him. So what we have is what we have. And, what he told me for, you know, whatever's true and what isn't, it's hard to kind of separate the wheat from the chaff at this point.
Well, right, but again, in all fairness, I mean, a lot of people have been approached over the years, and some of them were more influenced than others by their questioners, to be honest with you. And this is one of those lessons that quite, you know, nobody can teach you this, it seems like, when you're interviewing these people, not to bait the question, you know, and not to
right.
beg them to go into certain directions because that's where you're looking to go. You have to really sort of learn to be a cross-examiner of sorts in order to conduct an interview, but also not behave like you're cross-examining somebody because
absolutely.
A lot of people are very difficult to approach. Now, I'm going to get into somebody who was very difficult for you to approach in a minute because I love the story. And you do tell it in the book as well as, you know, laying it out, and it does relate to the FBI agents. But before we go there, there was more than one person in Pennsylvania, though, and I happen to know this for a fact, that was linked to the case. Now, why do I know this? Because I had been a traveling musician. You know, and I was from New Jersey, all right? So I went to New York, Pennsylvania, places like that. I also went to Canada and various other states. But more often than not, I would visit the tri-state area, so to speak, right? New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, this is where I played. And during my downtime, in a lot of cases, because I was reading so many books, I would look up people that I thought might have been in certain places, and did stumble across some interesting individuals. There was more than one in Pennsylvania, though, given certain time periods in the 90s, all right? And this all was going on, you know, around the time of the Assassination Records Review Board's work. So it's not as though nobody was approaching anybody, but you had to go to some pretty extreme lengths to get some of these interviews, and again, they're very rare because here's the thing. I want you to tell the story about the FBI agents. Now, I'll sort of lay out part of the groundwork here. There's always been a controversy regarding these two FBI agents who had taken notes and who were present in the autopsy room. And they were James Seibert and Francis X. O'Neill, all right, which, you know, you can read about them in a lot of places. There is testimony that does exist from each of these men. But quite honestly, the research community had never seemed to really get get a good interview with either one of them, to the best of my knowledge, with the exception of you. So I wouldn't mind if you told that story because this to me was one of the most remarkable things about the book and the collection of interviews in it. There's more that's remarkable about it. It's not just the FBI agents, but it is really, really fascinating that you got this done. And I wouldn't mind, I know you've told this story several times, and you told it again to me the other day, and I was thrilled to hear it yet again. But quite honestly, if you wouldn't mind, explain about your approach to Mr. Seibert and Mr. O'Neill, how that worked out and how that came about.
Well, I managed, I wanted to get, of all the people that I've interviewed for this book, that part of it I'm really most proud of because they weren't easy to get. I had been given a stack of papers from Lancer Publications where people had written and said, I'm a student, I'm doing a paper, please give me an interview. Or I'm an author writing a book, can you please take time to give me an interview? The only other person I know that had talked to either one of them at that point was David Lifton, and that was back in 19, and he only talked to Jim Seibert, that was back in 1966. So after reading all of this stuff, I knew that I had to have some sort of plan. If I just called them up and said, I would like to interview you. Will you please talk to me about it? I knew exactly what I was going to get. So I decided, after working on the book and having several interviews, I decided to use the book itself as a catalyst to try to get in to talk to these guys. And so I tracked down Jim Seibert. This was back in the day when you could do it. Just, you have to go through all kinds of search engines now and find people. But still at that point, it hadn't reached that point. You could basically call around and find people if you knew what you were doing. And so I did find Jim Seibert and got him on the phone and told him who I was, told him my name, told him I had this book coming out that I wanted to talk to him about it. And he talked to me a little bit and said that that he would I got him to talk about it a little bit, and he didn't tell me a lot. I didn't push it a whole lot because you're trying to be careful and not offend the guy. And so I had to talk to him, and then I asked him for the number of Frank O'Neill, and so he happened to have it there, and he gave it to me, and Seibert even offered me a picture for the book, and so I decided to call Frank O'Neill because I wanted to get to him to see if, he would give an interview as well. I was going to try to get these guys to go before the camera like I had Gerald Custer and some others at that point.
Right. Now, let's pause this explanation for a second, Mr. Law, for one reason. I want to make it clear to the listener that when you were making a cold call, okay, you know, you're calling somebody that doesn't know you. And I did this many times, and I got mm-hmm. phones slammed down on me. I got some insults. I got people telling me, listen, I've said all I've got to say. I don't want to talk anymore. I've gotten a lot of different reactions, right? And that ranges from, you know, anybody like from Mary Mormon, okay, all the way to James Tague, to different police officers in the DPD at the time. You call people up and you get a variety of reactions. So there's a bit of a negotiation that goes on, right?
Where
you have to kind of cater to where they're at and maybe know something about them. And there's usually like a little bit of a hook. Now, a guy like Gerald Custer, he was anxious to speak to people. And some people that are tied to the Gays, either directly or tangentially, are very anxious to speak to anybody. But some people not so much. And I think people need to appreciate that little bit of a dance you're doing. It's not really the most easy thing in the world to handle. You got to have a lot of nuances ready and waiting to deal with the situation, don't you?
Well, you do. Part of it is that I really enjoy this. I really enjoy talking to these people. And I think that comes across in my conversation with them. I try to put people at ease when I'm talking to them. I am sincere when I talk to them and say, you know, I would really like to ask you this. Can you give me a few minutes? Now, Jim Seibert, when I talked to him, he was pretty affable, and I asked him if he was that Jim Seibert. He said, yeah, that was me.
Right.
And so I had my foot a little bit in the door, and I got to ask him some questions. You know, there was a statement that they had made in these 5.5 pages of notes, the FD-302, where it said, you know, there had been surgery in the head area, namely in the top of the skull.
Right.
And I asked Jim Seibert about that, and he said, you know, I wish we would have rephrased it better. It would have saved some confusion in books. So he was basically saying that, you know, they just phrased it wrong. Well, we had this little conversation, and then I asked how I could get a hold of. I put it like this. I said, I want to do an oral history project, and I would like you to be part of it. So he was kind of wavering on it, and I said, well, could I speak to Frank O'Neill? Do you have contact information for him? I felt that if he knew his partner was going to be involved in this, that might loosen him up a little bit. Okay.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So he did indeed give me the number to Frank O'Neill, and he said, you know, call him. And I did. And I did the same thing. I said, you know, this is who I am. This is what I want to do. And he was pretty clipped, pretty cold. I got to ask him some questions. I pushed it. I started talking to him about, because I could sense that he did not really want to talk to me, and I was going to be talking to air very short. And
Get it in while you can.
Okay. And I said, I asked him about the autopsy pictures, and I said, can I, he said, no, I don't want to talk about it. I'll think about, you know, being a part of it, but I'm going to talk to Frank. I'm going to talk to Jim Seibert first before I do anything. So I said, you know, there's a point in your testimony before the Records Review Board where you said that the body looked different. And so he didn't really give me an answer. You know, I said, but I pushed it. I said, did the body in the photograph look like what you remember? And he said, in a very clipped voice, he said, no. Well, he told me I'd already pushed into the wall. And I said, can I just ask you one question? And he said, well, I've already told you I don't want to do it, but yeah, go ahead. So that's when I asked that question about, you know, did the body look like what you remembered in the photograph? And he says, no. Well, I'd used up my question. You know,
right.
He says, as far as an interview, he said, I'll have to think about it, but I'm going to call Jim Seibert first. So, I mean, he very abruptly ended the conversation. Well, I'd gotten along better with Seibert because he was friendlier. And I really felt that I had connected with Jim Seibert. Very friendly and toward me. And the offer of the picture, you know, I figured I've really got this guy, right? And so I waited a week. I called him back. He answers the phone, and his whole manner has changed. He, going from this nice, friendly, affable person, I said, you know, Mr. Seibert, it's William Long. And he says, yeah. I said, well, you said that I could call you and ask questions. And he said, you know, listen, he said, I've been getting calls, you know. He said, I'll be in my 90s by the time, you know, this all stops. He said, you will just have to wait until they release all these records, and then you'll know. And that pretty much ended, you know. Mm. So I did the same. I called Frank O'Neill, and boy, he put the kibosh on it. Said, I've already decided not to give you the interview, you know. That was the time that I pushed, I think, and said, you know, could I just ask you one question? And he said, well, I've already said I told you I don't want to be interviewed, but he said, go ahead, and that's when I asked about the body. So then it's the phone slammed down. I was really shocked because I thought I'd really, you know, put the hook in at least to one of them. Well, I know what happened. He called Frank O'Neill, called Jim Seibert, and said, look, don't talk to this guy. Unbeknownst to me at the time, he was writing his own book. Frank O'Neill.
Right.
And so he just wasn't going to talk about that. So I went on to do other interviews for the book. And just as I thought I had this thing to where I wanted it, that it was ready for publication, I thought, I've got to give this one more shot, see if, you know, I can do this so I could tell the reader I gave it my best shot, if nothing else. And so I did the same thing. I called Frank O'Neill. I told him who I was, told him I was writing a book. The only thing different is I said, I've got this manuscript in front of me. And I said, there was a man there named Gerald Custer. He took the x-rays of the body, and he said that you did this. And he said, well, no, that wasn't me. That we didn't do that. And then he went all through this thing, and the manner of this man had totally changed. I didn't lie to him. I didn't try to cover the fact that I had called him 3 years before. I just did it like I'd never talked to him before, and apparently he didn't remember me. So now he's kind of like, he's a little glad to hear from somebody. And he starts talking to me about how he was a paratrooper during the war and how he used to brief the president, you know, for his daily briefing, and he was even the guy that was the head of, in 72, when our athletes were killed, you remember all of that, where there was a bunch of athletes killed. He was the coordinator for all that. So we had a nice conversation, and he ended it with, you know, I said, you don't think there was any kind of conspiracy? He said, no, don't you think the Kennedys would have spent every dime that they had to find out if you know, there was a conspiracy. I did ask him again. I said, you know, you've seen those autopsy pictures. Did the body look like what you remember? And he said, there were just some different pictures we hadn't seen. That was all. So he had changed his tune on that. So I used that entry I would find a reason to call him every 2 or 3 weeks. Just so that I could plant the seed in his mind, not be too pushy, just say, hey, here I am, how are you, that sort of thing. And even when he was busy at this point, he would let me ask questions. So I would ask a series of questions, and we would always end on a good note. And I came across, in research, I came across a memo sent by a person that worked for CBS News that happened to go to the same church that Dr. Humes, the head prosector at the autopsy, they used to attend the same church. And in this memo, the news guy said, you know, I talked to Dr. Humes, and he said that these FBI agents weren't even in the room. Well, of course, I took that little piece of information so that I could use that as an excuse to call Frank O'Neill and tell him about it and see what would happen. So I did that. And when I called him up, we started off on a nice conversation, and I started asking a few questions. I said, look, I've got this document here by a CBS newsman that says that he went to church with Dr. Humes. And Dr. Humes said that you guys weren't even in the morgue room. And he angrily shot back at me, that is 100% wrong. I said, well, why do you think he would say that? He said, well, I have no idea, but I'd certainly like to see that. So I had the original source document. So I sent him the original source document.
Right.
And my whole point on trying to get to Frank O'Neill, part of it, was that I had gone back through his testimony, and nobody had found it yet. That he said when he went before the board, he said, I'm working on this book, and I've brought this with me for your records. So he had been writing his autobiography, and I wanted to get a peek at that because it might give more information about John Kennedy.
Right.
So I wanted to do anything I could to you know, have this man trust me enough that he would share things with me. I didn't know how much of a chance I had, but I thought, you know, I really want to get my hands on this document. So I sent him the source document. That gave me an opportunity to talk to him again. I sent him the document. I'm out in the backyard. This is not long after the attacks in 9/11. My girlfriend at the time, I'm out in the backyard doing some yard work, and she comes. She says, William, there's a man here, wants to talk to you. His name is Frank O'Neill. And I almost swallowed my tongue. And so I got the phone. I said, hello, Frank. I started to call him Frank, and I stopped myself, and I said, well, hello, Mr. O'Neill. How are you? And so we started talking about 9/11 and, you know, how things had gone, and two Americans, we were just, you know, really shaken. And he had gotten the source document. And so lo and behold, through a series of events, I get a package from him that contains this information that he'd written about John F. Kennedy. So not only that, he sent me some stuff that he'd written on anti-terrorism because he'd been involved in all that. He sent me that. The most interesting thing he did, he sent me a tape that he had done at Franklin Pierce Law School some years before, where he sat down with a group of researchers and supposedly had a really good knockdown, drag out, you know, kind of talk with some researchers, George Michael Evick, and I can't remember the others. And I thought, well, I'm really looking forward to you know, getting this from him so that I can really get in there and really push and really ask some questions. Well, when I put the tape in, it was like 5 minutes of tape. It had clearly been edited.
Right.
It was basically worthless. But the interesting stuff is he gave a good description of Kennedy's body after they opened the casket. Now, he had mentioned... I read this thing like three times before I caught it. And there was a portion in there where he said there had been some cutting of hair or removal of tissue, which would lend credence to, you know, surgery of the head area. And I really wanted to talk to him about that. I mean, nobody else had this document. Nobody knew about it. So I felt I'd really had something. And so I called him up. And it had gotten to that point where, you know, I'd sent him documents now. He'd sent me the tape. So I felt that, you know, I could really, really push it down. And then at that point, because we'd been talking a little bit and the fact that I'd given him the documents he wanted and he'd shared things with me, I just felt I could sit there and ask questions. And that's what I did. And he opened up and basically answered everything that I wanted to know. Well, what he was willing to tell me anyway. In an interesting conversation after 9/11, he said, you know, I'm going to go to Europe. And I said, you know, this is when we were still worried about getting on planes and things. I mean, it wasn't too long after, you know, that event. And so I said, well, surely you're not going to go. Now, this is after he told me, oh, the Warren Report got it right. You know, the government was honest, blah, blah, blah. And then he says, you know, I still have friends at the Bureau. And he still, I have friends in government. And they're telling me what's really going on, not what they want you to know. So I found that really interesting. So after that, you know, I got to ask all my questions. And some of it from his point of view, as far as I was concerned, with circular reasoning. But I decided to go on to Jim Seibert at that point. And when I called Jim Seibert, and this is after 3 years, I did the same thing. I just mentioned who I was, didn't lie about anything. I said, I'm doing this book, and here I am. And I have this piece from a man named Gerald Custer, and he said that you guys were at his hip, you know, from the time he took x-rays. And he said, no, that wasn't us. So I used that as the catalyst to get in and to ask questions. Now, I don't think it was because I was such a, you know, a great guy or smooth or a wonderful interviewer. With Jim Seibert, I think that I just happened to be pretty lucky in the fact that I think he was ready. He was up there in years a bit, and I think that he was ready to talk. And I think I hit him at the right time. And so I did the same thing. I would find a reason to call him every couple of weeks. I sent him books on the assassination. I found out that he had read several things. And so I knew that these people that call these guys up, all they wanted from them was, can you please talk to me? They never offered to do anything for them, never offered to give them anything. So I would do whatever I could, you know, to loosen them up a little bit. And I started sending books to Jim Seibert and on the assassination, new stuff that had come out. And so I waited for his response, and I held a regular job at that time, and I got home, and my girlfriend said some guy had called Jim Seibert and wanted to thank you for the books you'd sent. This is after a series of phone conversations that we'd had. And he called me the next day, and he said, you know, I wasn't expecting anything like this. Good night, you know. So at that point, I was just free to ask questions. And I knew that, you know, I had pushed these guys just as bad as far as you could. I had, you know, found reasons to call them over an extended period of time. They'd always taken my calls at this point. I knew that Jim Seibert had never, outside of a governmental body, given an interview. And so now it was here it was. I was either going to get this or I wasn't. I'd tried it with Frank O'Neill, and he said I could speak to him over the phone, but he would not allow me to come out to his house. That's one thing he wouldn't do, mm-hmm. but he did answer my questions over the phone. With Jim Seibert, I held my breath and I said, you know, it's kind of hard. I'm still working on this book, and it's really hard to write about a person if you haven't met them. I said, there's some people in your area that I would like to interview, and if I ever get down your way, would you mind if I interviewed you? And I held my breath. I mean, actually, I just held my breath, and I heard him say, no. And I thought, well, I've blown that. And he said, no, I wouldn't mind.
Ah.
So
there you go.
So, I mean, I literally, you know, my breath exploded. And I immediately booked a plane. So, like, I'm going to be there in, like, X amount of weeks.
Well, you didn't want that situation to happen with that phone call like before where, you know, all of a sudden, I was going to talk to you, but no. You didn't want that, so you're like, I better get on this while the getting's good, basically, because, again.
That's right.
Yeah, okay.
The old saying of strike while the iron's hot.
There
because
you go.
Because how did I know How did I know that he wasn't going to call Frank O'Neill or Frank O'Neill was going to call him? I let them both know that I'd been in touch with each other because I wanted them to be comfortable. But, you know, you never knew. I did learn from Jim Seibert. He said, we send Christmas cards to each other, but that's about it. So I immediately got the first plane I could get, made arrangements with him. Deborah Conway at Lancer, said, boy, I'd really like to go on that. And I said, well, listen, you can go. Just be the document lady. She said, I'll be the document lady, and I'll have the documents. So I had to call and say, I'm bringing a friend with me, and, she's really interested in this, and would you mind? And so he said, no, I'll bring her. And so we traveled there, and I am just really excited now because I know historically I'm going to be the first guy to sit down with Jim Seibert, and he's going to talk to me. And that was important to me. Meeting one of these guys, this thing that I was so desperately trying to get for the book, had a twofold purpose. Yes, I wanted to get it for the book. I wanted it for history. But I wanted my own personal experience of being able to reach out and touch history.
Right.
That's what this whole thing really was for me.
Well, it's
amazing.
And
I was going to get that opportunity.
Yeah, it's amazing the amount of people that you were actually successful with, putting together. Again, nobody has done a book like yours. So this is, again, you talked about Lifton, and yeah, Lifton had taped some interviews, and he had, his over a long period of time. It took him quite a while to get Best Evidence out. I think it's until 1980. And as you you stated there, he had conducted one of those interviews in 1966, so think about it, okay?
Right. Let me tell you another little piece of this.
Sure.
The next day, I had brought a little camera with me. I was aware that he had never done an on-camera interview before. And so I had this little camera that I didn't want to come in there. I didn't say I'm going to come and I'm going to tape you. I said, I'm going to write about you. So Deborah Conway had a folder full of documents. I had this little camera. I put it in a little blue bag, and I had a plan. So when we meet, we get our hotel room. The next day's coming. We're having breakfast together. And before Jim got there to direct us to his living apartment, I looked over at Deborah, and I said, look, Deborah, I got a plan. I said, I have this little camera that I want to set up, and I want to camcord Jim Seibert if he lets me. So I'm going to casually say, would you mind if I videotape this? And if he says no, I reached in the bag and I pulled out this little recorder, and I gave it to her, and I said, I want you to say, well, William, I have this little recorder if it will help you. She's looking at me like, I don't know if I can pull that off. And I'm like, I said, if he says no to that, then you just sit in a corner with a pad and a pencil and you write as fast as you can. So I hear his voice. I go out front. We greet each other. Here's this guy. I think at that point he was like 83 or 84. Snow white hair, chiseled face. Glasses, steel rim glasses, dressed very casually in a shirt and pair of slacks and some moccasins. And, the one thing that I wanted to do was confirm, if I could, from him, Paul O'Connor's statement about there being no brain in the cranium. Because that was a big part of the mystery. Was or was there not a brain in the president's head when the body was received at Bethesda Naval Hospital?
Right.
And I'm racking my brain. How in the hell am I going to bring this subject up to Frank, to Jim Seibert? How am I going to, just blurt out this question? So we gather our stuff. He's going to drive us to get our rental car, and then he's going to take us to his apartment. So we get in the back of the car. He introduces me to his wife. Deborah's sitting in the back with me. And I said something along the lines of, you know, Mr. Seibert, I am so glad that, you know, we're getting this opportunity to talk to you because you had your hands on the body of the President of the United States. You can answer all these questions I have. And his dear little wife looks back at me and she says, well, you know, his brains were all blown out of his head. I felt like I'd broken the bank at Monte Carlo. I mean, you know, of course, you know what happened after the autopsy. Jim went home and he said, Esther, guess what? I was there during the autopsy of President Kennedy, and he didn't have any brains in his head. You know, and so she had repeated, well, his brains were all blown out of his head. And I said, well, that was one of the questions I was going to ask. So, and in the book, what follows is what happens after we get to his office. And he did indeed, I thought, you know, I'm going to have to go through this whole thing. Will you please let me video this? I got this plan all set up. And I said, would you mind if I camcorder this? And he said, no, go ahead. So I didn't have to go through any kind of, you know, big drawn-out scenario. He just said, yeah, go ahead.
All that anxiety for nothing.
All that anxiety for nothing. And Deborah and I spent, I believe we spent that first visit with a break for dinner, which he took us. They lived in this nice, plush, very nice complex. It had everything. Right across from their own hospital, it had everything. It had a barbershop. It had a weight room. It had their own dining area and bar, and he was very proud of it.
Right.
He even took us over and gave us a tour of the hospital, you know, took us up on the floors and stuff and showed us all the stuff, took us into the weight room where he sat down and did some shoulder presses on some Nautilus equipment stuff. And I could not believe that here I am talking to Jim Seibert, and he's talking to me just like I'm, you know, just this friend of his, and he's, it, for me, it was an unbelievable experience. I mean, we got to sit down at dinner, and people, you know, they didn't have a lot of visitors and stuff. So when Jim Seibert showed up with Deborah and I were sitting there with his wife at the table, there were people there that were from the beginnings of the CIA. I mean, it was incredible. Famous people that had been in World War II. I mean, they would come by and ask what was going on, and Esther would proudly say, well, this man is writing a book about Jim. And so it was all a wonderful experience. Jim Seibert was very relaxed. He would look at me and his wife was saying, you know, Jim's always been a bit of a jokester. And he would look at me and his eyes were literally sparkling. I think it really, really was nice for him to have his wife, you know, tell his friends, oh, this man is going to write a book about Jim, which wasn't entirely true, but he surely had a big part in it. So that was a wonderful experience, and you can read about that in the IF history.
Well, no, that's true. It is all there in the original edition, and actually, when I was taking a look at what is contained in the updated edition, there's apparently an addendum to the section on Jim Seibert too, right?
There is. I kept in touch with Jim over the years. Now, I have to tell you that we had a wonderful session, and I later went back with a camera crew that from Canada that was, and I leaned on him to, first I went back in 2002 where I did a film shoot. I asked him if he would come along. I was going to gather the people that I'd interviewed for the book, those of us that, you know, that were still on the planet. And I said, you know, I'd really like to do this. Would you like to be part of it? He said, well, William, I'm getting up there a little bit now. And he says, I really can't travel. He said, you know, I don't want to get, you know, involved in the, you know, all the controversy about the caskets and stuff. He knew all about that. He knew about, you know, the caskets. He'd read about it. He knew Best Evidence. He knew a lot of different books. Let me tell you this. Let me backtrack a little bit. While we were still doing the interview in his office,
the initial one with the camcorder and all that.
The initial book.
Right.
The initial interview. He had a shelf full of books ranging from Death of a President to Lifton's book where I read him the page from Death of a President where the casket was taken in by the honor guard. Officially, the honor guard took the casket in at 8 o'clock. Now, they, in their notes, said that they, meaning him and Frank O'Neill, and the driver and the passenger in the limousine of President Kennedy, took the casket in at 7:17. I read him the part where the honor guard supposedly took the casket in. He said, you know, I've heard about that. But he said, you know, there was nobody but us. He said, we took the casket in, and he said there might have been a few people come out from the medical complex there. But he said there was nobody dressed in uniforms. There was nothing like that, which is all part of the mystery. So he said that at least what the one he brought in did not happen. I lost my train of thought. I was going to tell you something else about that.
Well, it's interesting because look, there's so many controversies you just went over here. First of all, the missing brain of John F. Kennedy. This has been one of those things that there is indeed a picture in the National Archives of a brain, which does not comport with apparently what a lot of witnesses saw that is alleged to be John F. Kennedy's. There is a lot of controversy about the weight of it, about how it was preserved, and what its actual disposition was, you know. And on top of it, even when you're talking about the caskets coming in, you know, I've read a detailed story before about somebody having to find some sort of cart to get the casket in through the back entrance. But then again, there's something that came in through the front entrance. I mean, there is a lot of confusion here regarding exactly how this was done. Now, I have ideas about how this might have all gone down, but the truth is you have a lot of conflicting statements from individuals who really have no reason to give conflicting statements. And one of them is key here. This is Seibert and O'Neill. They would have no reason to report anything other than what they actually did. And it conflicts with this concept of, again, the guard coming in, the joint services, which means you're going to have somebody from the Army, the Navy, the Air Force, you know, the Marines all together. You're going to see a lot of different uniforms, all in dress uniforms.
That's should right. Be basically all of the branches dressed in their uniforms,
right.
Dress uniforms.
In their best.
So if they were out there.
Yeah.
If they were out there, surely you would see it. And Jim Seibert said that there wasn't anything like that, which is extremely mysterious.
Well, there wouldn't be if he was carrying something in at 7:17 and these guys were coming in at 8 o'clock. Now the question is, who was carrying in what? You know, and here you go. There's a lot of questions. Now what's really remarkable, again, about your book is that I don't see you going to the extent of trying to create a story out of anything. You let these people tell their own stories in the book, and it's basically there for you to kind of navigate it on your own. That's what I love about it. We're coming up to the time where we want to take a break here, and I do want to get to you about a couple other topics before we run out of time, but the first hour is gone, just so you know.
It went fast, didn't it?
It went really quickly. I mean, despite the fact that I ran my mouth for the first 10 minutes, I was enthralled by the story once again, because I've heard this story before. I know a lot of people who are listening have not. But I guarantee I've heard this story before. I've read it. And, you know, In the Eye of History is just one of the books that William Mattson Law. And again, I'm going to there's a WordPress site for you, which I found, by the way. But quite honestly, you can just go to, like, say, Amazon or one of these booksellers if you like. Or if you're at the Lancer conference, I guarantee you there's copies of In the Eye of History that are available there.
I'm also going to be at the Judith Vary Baker conference.
Okay.
And so I'll be there. And, I have a new book, with James Jenkins, who was one of the men who was in the autopsy room. It took me 20 years to get him to even go to a conference. And, I can talk a little bit about him when we come back if you'd like.
Absolutely. I want to get into that.
You lead me where you want to go, and I'll answer your question.
Well, that would be, what is the title I don't have in front of me, but it's like The Cold Shoulder of History, I think it's called, isn't it?
Yes. It's called At the Cold Shoulder of History. He stood at the right shoulder of the president while they were performing an autopsy, and his job was to help the doctors with whatever they needed.
Mm.
And I'll leave this before we go to commercial. He says there was a brain, and he did infuse a brain.
See, here you go again, right? Now, the FBI agents, the brains are blown out. There was no brain. And they're not the only ones who said it, either. And yet, there are others who say, look, there was a brain. It was taken out. It was treated exactly in this way with a solution and, you know, yep. preserved as properly as would be seen in the photographs, although, according to the description of those photographs, seems like the brain is a little too intact to have realistically been the one that was disrupted by a missile in some way or other. But, hey, again, lots of controversy to be had, but what you did with this book, and I'm sure I haven't read, you know, At the Cold Shoulder of History. I have not read that one, but I'm almost willing to bet that what you've done there is, again, allowed the individuals who are directly involved to tell their story. And, you know, you facilitated that, obviously, working with Jim Jenkins directly. And I do want to get into that, you know, a bit. This is not going to be the only show I have with you, though, if I get my way, because there's a lot. I mean, there's a whole list of people we didn't even mention that were in the first book that I find to be a remarkable piece of work and absolutely essential if you are someone who is trying to learn the real details. You know, from the individuals, unless you're going to travel around, and now you can't even talk to a lot of these people because they have passed away. But indeed, if you were to
most
go back
of those
in time,
people in that mm-hmm. most of those people in that book that I've interviewed are gone now.
Right.
And
so,
I am so grateful I was able to have that opportunity.
So you
Jim
could,
Jenkins is the last man standing, so to speak.
Right. So you could not even possibly recreate this. You, the listener, I mean, you could not possibly recreate what it is that that William Law put together in the eye of history. But we're going to get to some of his other work, too. There's a few other things which I did include in the graphic. And again, I'll put the links to various works by you in the show notes and all that when we post this as a podcast. But right now, we're going to go to a break. William Matson Law is with me, and we are talking about In the Eye of History, but also the latest pieces of work and a few things that I missed, quite honestly, over the past couple of years that he's done as well. In the next hour, we can get to it all here on the O'Kelly Effect. Stick around.
Gold, silver, the stock market. WallStreetWindow.com. The brilliant author of The War State brings you exclusive reports about the big changes upcoming in the markets. WallStreetWindow.com. Perhaps you're invested deeply. Perhaps you're not in deep enough. Maybe you're thinking about getting started. WallStreetWindow.com. Michael Swanson, the brilliant author of The War State, understood these trends professionally for many years, and now he gives you the benefit of his knowledge. WallStreetWindow.com. Go there now. Go there now. Go there now.
Hey there, it's Sunshine On, and I just wanted to stop by, say thanks to all you amazing listeners who are the O'Kelly Effect of Inspiration, for your host Chuck O'Kelly to remain free of paid corporate masters with ads that instill fear to sell products they want you to buy. Media's best independent network for guest interviews and the most unique perspectives. And yeah, my perspective's kind of unique, right? So anyway, I just wanted to say thank you so much for tuning in, and let's keep it all ongoing. You can join in by clicking the donate button. Together, you are the O'Kelly Effect.
Going to Chuck O'Kelly. Coachella. You know it's Chuck Coachella.
You are about to embark upon the great crusade. The eyes of the world are upon you. The hopes and prayers of liberty-loving people everywhere march with you. In company with our brave allies and brothers in arms on other fronts, your task will not be an easy one. Your enemy is well-trained, well-equipped, and battle-hardened. He will fight savagely, man to man. The tide has turned. The free men of the world are marching together to victory. Good luck. And let us all beseech the blessing of Almighty God upon this great and noble undertaking.
Did I do this before? I think I did.
Now, your host, Chuck O'Chelly, calling it like he sees it. Seriously, guys? God, how do you do that right? I hope you're laughing too, Chuck. Did I do this before? I think I did. Seriously, guys? Most other media outlets are paid by corporate sponsors to present you with an agenda of instilling fear to sell you products. Not Chuck. Chuck wouldn't do that. Who wants to be a corporate master? How do you do that right?
News, entertainment, and more. You will learn something, children's. Ocelli.com.
We should learn from our relatively recent history, my brother. That's where I'm coming from. I say all power to the people.
And now, the most underrated voice in all media.
The second hour of the O'Chelly Effect begins now here at O'Chelly.com. Do appreciate you for tuning in. And yeah, this is going to be one of those ones that we submit to the FM also. So we'll see exactly where it gets carried. But do appreciate you for being tuned in on this Wednesday. I have William Mattson Law with me, who is the author of In the Eye of History. That is one book that I absolutely recommend and endorse. I tell you that it's part of your essential reading. However, I got to say that maybe I have to amend my statement a bit, because there's an updated version of it. So even if you have it, you may have to go out and get the updated version. Why? It includes a DVD with some really interesting footage, and I am waiting to get a copy of this myself. I guarantee you guys I'm going to talk about it. I've mentioned it many times when I've gone into the, you know, hey, let's begin to delve into the medical evidence discussions. As a matter of fact, if I think very carefully, I'm very sure that during my interviews with Sherry Feaster that we certainly talked about the book as well, and various other books too. But anyway, you know, the late Sherry Feaster, whose work I still tell you guys to go take a look at. The Enemy of the Truth is the name of her book. It's still out there and available, despite the fact that she is no longer with us. Anyway, William Mattson Law is with us, and you know, it is very, very good to kind of get a recap. And honestly, I'm so glad to have you on the show. You're one of those people I always wanted to get on this show, and just didn't really find a way to get in touch with you. Again, big thanks to Larry Hancock, not only because, you know, he facilitated this, but Larry has been extremely helpful and wonderful to getting me to get people on the show. And, you know, I'm pretty sure he's entirely responsible for the whole reason why I went to Lancer last year and everything else. But anyway.
Larry Hancock is a really good writer and a decent guy. He really is.
On a wide variety of subjects. I mean, I'm doing specials on some of his other stuff that isn't related to the Kennedy assassination also, while he's, you know, doing these series with us, the JFK 101 series. Again, I urge you guys to go ahead and search it at the website, because, you know, we are up to the ARRB, so we're almost done with the official investigations, okay? Anyway, William Mattson Law, but, you know, I'm not giving In the Eye of History, really, it's due. There's a lot of other people in that book outside of the FBI agents and Cheryl Custer. I mean, give people an idea. I could pull up a list right now, but I don't like reading while I'm on the air. Who else is in this book? And you know, if you could tag on a little bit about who they are and why they were of interest, you know, because, again, this is how long did this take to write, actually? That's another interesting question.
Well, at the time, this was all taking place. I think I started the real research on it in 97. And it took me about six years, somewhere around in there, because I was working a full-time job. I had young children then. They're grown now. But I was doing all that and trying to complete it. And, you know, just as I had time and the money and, you know, I had to either fly people in or, you know, go to where they were. And so it took a bit of time to do that. Some of the people that are in the book. Well, the first person that the guy I really wanted to talk to in a bad way was Paul Kelly O'Connor. Paul Kelly O'Connor was one of the technicians that helped the doctors the night of the autopsy. And his job was normally to do a craniotomy, which I can get into this, I suppose. This is the procedure where you cut into the scalp, cut into the skull, cut the thick membrane that covers the brain, and through a series of things, take the brain out of the head. However, Paul said when he saw the body that there was no brain to be removed, that it basically had been all blown out. I really want to talk to this guy. I'd seen him on a few interviews. And he was, you know, these guys all seem to be cut from the same cloth. They really care about this country. They did their jobs.
Well, Paul O'Connor was, in fact, a Navy corpsman who wound up serving in Vietnam, if memory serves me correctly.
He did, and he was in an explosion or a jeep wreck. I can't remember which. And he hurt his back. And that back injury gave him problems for the rest of his life. We got to have several conversations. I said, you know, Paul, I'd really like to, you know, have you be a part of this book. Unlike the FBI agents, Paul was one of those people, that was bigger than life. And he did not know a stranger. He was a really affable person. And although he lived with pain on a daily basis, he had learned to do it with grace and look at life with hope and promise. And that came across when you talked to him and when you met him. He's one of those guys that you hope they're going to be a certain way, and he certainly was. I can remember when I picked him up from the airport. You know, he'd been sitting on a plane, and his back was bothering him. I knew he was in pain. Now, Paul, on our way home, I live in Oregon, and of course, Lewis and Clark traveled through that part of the country which I used to live. And so we're going back to where I live in Oregon. And so we happened to be going through the Dalles and across the Columbia River. It was at night, but across that was part of the land where they had been and stayed. And my brother-in-law, who was with me, pointed out and said, Lewis and Clark stayed, you know, right sort of kind of in that area at some point. And I can remember he was like a little kid. He craned his neck over to look out the window and said, where? I mean, he was just as excited to hear about that part of history as, you know, and here this guy was one of the members, a big piece of this history and one of the darkest events in our nation. I had a great time with him. We sat and he answered every question I put to him. He couldn't be nicer. When I took him to his hotel and dropped him off for the night, I called the next morning to see if he was ready so we could start some interviews. He'd already been down to the town, made a friend of the hotel clerk there, and somebody answered the phone and said, hey, Paul, somebody's calling for you. So that's just the kind of person he was. he was a wonderful person. I wish everybody could have had the chance to meet him.
Mm. No, and an interesting guy, too, because if memory serves me correctly, he flew to Oregon to meet with you. Was he living
in
Florida at the time?
He was in Florida, and you know, he slept in a hospital bed. That's how bad his back was. Mm. And and he accepted my invitation and came out, and we had some really nice conversations. My brother-in-law, Robert, were really taken with him, and we all hit it off just fabulously. And you know, we all had dinner. We ordered in pizza at one point, and I just had such a wonderful time listening to stories of being in the Navy, a lot of which I could not mention over radio. But it was just a really good time. You know, and I got to ask him all those questions that I wanted to know. Of course, he is the person that opened up this Pandora's box about the assassination when he said that Kennedy's body arrived in a metal shipping casket, and inside the shipping casket was a body bag, and inside the body bag was the body of John F. Kennedy. Well, of course, that is not the official version of what happened. The official version is that Kennedy's body was put into a 400-pound ceremonial casket in Dallas, Texas, wrapped in some sheets, with extra sheets around the head, and then taken to Andrews, Love Field, and then thrown from Love Field to Andrews, and then taken from Andrews Air Force Base to Bethesda, Maryland, where the autopsy was performed, and that autopsy did not start or take place, and the body did not come in until 8 o'clock. That is official history. Unofficial history is the body showed up around 6:30, 6:35 in a metal shipping casket inside of a body bag, and this is the casket that Paul O'Connor remembers being set on the floor. They take the lid off of it. Just a cheap metal shipping casket, like you used to say, like they used to ship bodies home from Vietnam in.
Right.
They take the lid off. There's a body bag inside the casket, or the shipping casket. They unzip the body bag and place the body on the table. The body's nude except for wrappings around the head. So that's what we got from Paul O'Connor.
Right, and of course, people have seen some of that testimony. Like, say, if you watch The Men Who Killed Kennedy, Paul O'Connor plays a pivotal role in some of the early episodes of that. He's the guy with the beard and the glasses, you know, and he was...
Deep baritone voice, yes.
Deep baritone voice, looked like a pretty large guy. I heard stories about Paul. I never met him, but I heard stories about him that, you know, he drank a little, but he was an extremely, like a big teddy bear kind of guy.
Oh, he was the most wonderful person.
and he'd actually been a police officer after his military career?
He had been a police officer and retired out of that. The injury that he received in Vietnam was really, really bad to his back, and he spent the rest of his days basically in pain from that.
Yeah, well, back injuries are brutal. You know, you're talking to a guy in his mid-40s who requires a cane, you know.
Well, so I have the same problem. On a bad day, I have the same problem.
I'm telling you, I can't. It's amazing. Once you break a bone in your back and your neck, it will affect you the rest of your life. And actually, Paul had suffered a pretty severe injury from what I remember. But again, it's really great. You had him actually come out to your house and sit down with you, and you filmed him as well, right?
I filmed him as well, and I could tell during the filming that there were times when he was really in pain, and you know, he would kind of move around a little bit, and so I tried to do what we could to, you know, alleviate that, let him get up and move around and stuff. But he was absolutely wonderful as far as, you know, just answering whatever questions I had. Over the years, we became quite close, and he would call me up, I would call him up, just not to talk about the Kennedy assassination, but just to, you know, talk about things going on in our lives and how was everyone. And he loved the Gators in Florida, the college team, and he was a big supporter of them. And so he would talk to me about that. One day, he would call me up when he'd get some, you know, somebody would find out where he was and call him. And boy, he would say, you know, I really got a call from a nut today. And he would share with me what, you know, what the thing was. And so one day he called me and said, buddy, you're never going to guess what happened. He said, I was going into the door of my own house, and he said, I tripped and fell, and I fractured my hip, and I didn't know it, and I tried to get up, and I fell down again and broke my wrist. And explosive laughter on the other end of the phone. You know, he had all kinds of medical problems. And but that was Paul. He just, you know, tried to make the best of every situation. And sometime later, I received a phone call telling me that he had died in his sleep. It was devastating.
Well, not to linger on that too long, because, you know, again, everybody's getting up in age who was around then. We're talking about 55 years later now. And, I mean, you know, if you were an adult then, let's just say you were 20 years old at the time, and a lot of people were older. Did you ever attempt to interview the main autopsist? Because I got to tell you, it was a remarkable thing to try and get a hold of one of them. A long time ago, probably around the same time you were doing research for your book, I got a phone number, and it was one of those crazy, like, you know, you got to dial eight different things and talk to
an
international operator, because somebody had left the country. I bet you know who I'm talking about here.
Yes, I do.
And, you know, it was interesting, but there's a lot of people that you talk to, some of the doctors, some of the people that were assistants there in one way or another. You also, let's take a look at this. Bob McClellan is in the updated version. You know, he's a remarkably sharp witness, or at least was a couple of years ago. You know, I don't know how things are at the moment, to be honest with you. I haven't kept track of
I did interview him for the new edition. The first time I met him was at a conference, and I'm walking inside the building, and Deborah Conway was beside somebody, and they were walking toward me. I thought, that looks like Dr. McClellan. And it was. And she said, Williams came up to me and she said, William, I have some things I absolutely have to take care of. This is Dr. McClellan. Could you please take care of him and get him settled while I'm gone? So I took him over to the bar. We got a drink. And then as soon as people saw me with this guy, we were surrounded. I mean, a mob of people surrounded him and started to ask questions. Well, he's at this point, he's in his late 70s. So I let him do it for a while, and then I thought, well, you know, I need to get him set down so he can be comfortable. And I said, ladies and gentlemen, we gotta get him somewhere so he can sit down. And so I would get him out of there, and we would start walking, and I would ask a question. So then he would stop, and I would ask my question, and people would see that we had stopped. And wherever we would stop, they would gather around him, and then he would have this this group of people around him wanting to ask questions. Well, this happened like two or three times, and at the end of it, I just thought, oh, hell with this. You know, he's having a wonderful time. Let him go as long as he wants.
Right.
Well, that's what he did. People got to ask all kinds of questions of him. I got to ask my own, and I was still working on the update at that point. The book had been out for some years. And so I did call him sometime after that. I had his number. He was very personal. He said, yeah, I remember who you were. And so he gave me an interview for the book and gave his personal opinions. And the wonderful thing about him is that, you know, he said, you know, he stood at the head there for in trauma room one and was asked to hold, you know, basically the throat wound open, and he got a good look at, you know, the throat and the wound, and the head wound and all that. So he's in there, told me exactly what he was doing, who came and got him when they heard the news, gave me a great description of what they used to call the pit, the emergency room when these cases would come in.
Right.
This is for me what it was all about, being able to be with these people and be with them and talk to them and basically sit next to history. I mean, I just looked at it like that, like, I'm never going to have this opportunity again.
Well, see, this is the great thing, though, because it's a diverse group of people that you put together between the original version and the update. You know, quickly, let's just go through a couple of them. Sandra Spencer is somebody, and also Harold Rydberg, right?
Harold Rydberg was terrific. He was the Warren Commission artist that they came and got him, I believe he said, on a Friday, said, bring your brushes and your boards, meaning the stuff that he was going to draw on. He was taken into a room, and they gave him the cover of it. At some point, I think it was the Thresher had stunk or something, and they gave him some kind of cover about the Thresher, and that's why he was there. They put him in a room, didn't allow him to have any pictures of President Kennedy. He had to draw those now famous drawings that you've seen in the Warren Commission report. And if any of you have seen the movie JFK, they use those same boards, those same pictures, drawings,
It's the medical, the medical illustrations. And
yes.
Not the ones, well, hang on, not the ones that some people have confused for photographs, but the ones that are clearly like, from a textbook drawing that,
yes.
You know, that, yes. that show like the brain and also Kennedy's hair kind of sort of. And the trajectory of the bullet is often shown through these pictures and all this
yes.
stuff. You're talking about the guy who actually created those.
Absolutely.
Yes.
And he, like Paul O'Connor, I did my first interviews with him over the phone. He had a baritone voice. Made raspy and gravelly through years and years of smoking cigarettes. Very pleasant to talk to, gave me all of his opinions. He told me that he was taken in on a Friday, told to draw the description of Kennedy and the wounds verbally by Dr. Humes and Dr. Boswell. Just using their verbal descriptions, they wouldn't let him have anything else. And then those drawings were taken before the Warren Commission and used on Monday. Can you imagine that?
Without ever getting to see anything.
anything. And sometime later when I was doing some work for Gala Film Company out of Canada, we got Harold to come in and met him in person and we talked. And like Paul O'Connor, he was very outgoing, very friendly, exuded warmth, tall, the same raspy voice, a great guy. We had many conversations over a period of years. I'm sorry to say that we lost him some time back, but he was a terrific man.
Well, right. And, you know, there are a lot of terrific people and a lot of interesting characters that you can encounter. But certainly, again, this is a diverse group of people. Doug Horn, you interviewed for the update because he had worked on the military records part of the Assassination Records Review Board and therefore was also deeply involved in this whole reexamination of the medical evidence in a weird way, although there was no investigative arm of the Assassination Records Review Board.
Right.
They sort of conducted a pseudo-investigation about the veracity of the existing medical evidence.
Their job was to gather the information. They were not to analyze it. They weren't to reach conclusions. They were there just to gather all the documents they could get their hands on.
Well, right, and Doug Horn's an interesting figure, but also Dennis David, somebody that I didn't mention earlier. I probably should have. He was chief of the day there at Bethesda, and an interesting character over the years. Somebody who actually was genuinely surprised when certain people revealed the alleged official record to him about a lot of things. Dennis David was an interesting guy.
Dennis David was an interesting guy, absolutely. He was slight build, wiry. He was just terrific. When I contacted him and started talking to him about it and what I wanted to do, he agreed that he would be part of the project. This is while I'm still working on the initial book. And I said, listen, I was kind of hoping he would, you know, let me come out to where he was living, because he was living, I think, in Chicago, and I'd never been to Chicago at that point. I think that's where he was living in Illinois, Hoopston, Illinois, or something like that. I can't remember now. And I was hoping he'd let me go out there and visit him there, because I wanted to see some of the country. He said, well, I kind of like to come out to Oregon. So I brought him out to Oregon, and he, although the oldest of the group, I think he was in his 20s, I think he was 26 when all this happened, he, in some ways, seemed to be the youngest. I mean, he just had that, particular air about him. He walked at a fast gait. I took him around my town in a little two-seat convertible that I had that was pretty flashy, and I had the top up, and I was driving him around town. And he looked at me and he chided me and said, hey, you ever have the top down on this thing? So he is responsible he is the guy that gave the orders to 6 or 7 enlisted men from the dental school and other places to take the cheap metal shipping casket out of what he used to call a black Cadillac hearse ambulance, flash ambulance, and take it in and set it on the floor. So that jives with Paul O'Connor's memories of having this casket, cheap metal shipping casket,
but it
floor.
Doesn't jive with the publicly accessible footage of Jackie Kennedy disembarking from Air Force One, getting into a gray Navy ambulance, which,
no.
You know, where the casket was supposed to have also gone. She went with it. We can all find that footage now online, but quite
right.
Honestly, that was broadcast live that night. And that doesn't comport with what you would expect coming from that, does it?
No, the body, at least the casket that he unloaded, showed up at least 20 minutes before the official arrival of the official ambulance that had the official casket in it. And he watched Jacqueline Kennedy and Bobby Kennedy and other dignitaries go up to the 17th floor, which is where the presidential suite was at that time. And so, you know, I don't think any of these guys connected a lot of this stuff until years later when they started learning about the inconsistencies. So he gave the order to do that. He also tells the story about being asked by a Secret Service agent, a guy in a suit, to type a memorandum. He was given a vial, a little pill vial that had 4 or 5 pieces of metal in it. He said, enough for more than one bullet, but not necessarily enough two. He's looking at this vial, and the guy, whatever he was, Secret Service or whatever agent he was, said, it's okay, you can look at them. He poured them out into his hand and was able to look at them. He typed up this memorandum saying that these I can't remember it exactly, but saying that the pieces of bullet had come from the head of John F. Kennedy on this date. And after he typed this memorandum, he was the typewriter ribbon was taken from the typewriter. They took all evidence of anything and said, forget I was here.
Which
this did not happen.
Yeah, and you know, quite frankly, there was a lot of non-disclosure about a lot of things, which was understandable to some degree, but when you have all this sort of confusion between these accounts, it becomes very interesting, especially because a lot of this paperwork that's supposedly existed doesn't exist any longer. A lot
that's
of the
correct.
Evidence that, whether it's the brain or it's something else, may or may not still exist, but cannot be found. You know, I mean, there's a lot of interesting aspects to this. And meanwhile, the last one I'm going to mention here is Jim Jenkins. And why? Well, because you've actually written a new book with him, as we mentioned in the first hour. And, you know, I don't know if you're the ghostwriter, the co-author. I don't know how to put it there because I haven't seen this one yet.
It was a true collaboration between Jim and myself. I had known this guy for 20 years before. I finally got to him enough to where he would go to a conference with me. And he went to the 50th anniversary. I'd been banging on him for years. Jim, would you, you know, come to the come to the conference. You'll have a really good time, you know. And he's the one that called and told me about Paul's passing. Of all the people that I've interviewed ever, Jim Jenkins was and is absolutely the most reluctant person to get into this. He has changed somewhat in the last few years because we've been working on this project together, but he's a person that did not, you know, look for glory or the light or anything of that. He just didn't want that to be on him. Let me tell you how I managed to bring that off in the short time that we have left. I had read about Jenkins, but I'd only read about him in a couple of different books. And I think one was Best Evidence, where he was interviewed for that. And I think the next one was probably something having to do with Harrison Livingstone, who is no longer with us. I tracked him down, and I talked to him, and he did talk to me, and I wrote some notes about, you know, he said that the Warren Commission was concocted as a show, you know, told me a few other things. I jotted them down. Tried to, you know, I had several conversations with him. I didn't want to push too hard. I understood that he was reluctant, that he didn't want to delve into this too much. And so finally, after some conversations, I decided to hit him up. And I said, you know, I think what I said was, you know, if you let me come down there and interview you right now, I can get a really good price on a ticket. So he said, you can, huh? So I said, yeah, I can. And so he agreed to meet with me. Now, in my head, since he had said, you know, yes to me, I thought, you know, I'm gonna take a camera, a film camera. I'm gonna have, you know, time enough. We're gonna spend the day together. I'm gonna take him to the French Quarter. We're gonna find a place out in the sunshine. I'm gonna set this whole thing up. We're just gonna have a nice little go at it. So when I get there, you know, the whole thing, I felt trepidation through the whole thing. I thought, God, this guy's not going to show up. He's not going to do it. Well, the next day he calls me. I'm getting things ready. And he says, I'm in the lobby. So I go down to the lobby, and there he is. And he's like, he seemed to be like 6'6", but I've since learned he's about 6'3". And he's standing there, a shock of white hair, white beard to match. A crisp white shirt with black buttons, slacks. I mean, and he's got his hands deep in his pocket. And he turns, he's been looking at a picture on the wall, and he turns to me, and he says, well, hello, William. And we shake hands. And I said, are you hungry? Let's go over to this restaurant around the corner and get some breakfast. So we did that. And we're sitting there, and he says, oh, I'm not hungry. I'll just have a Coke. So I was absolutely starving, not having eaten, you know, much from the day before. But I said, I'll just have a Coke, too. So we're sitting there, and he starts talking about, you know, I was 19 or 20 when I found out that my country was no better than a third world country. He said, I don't trust people. I don't trust people, and I don't trust the government. And this thing was the start of it. Mm. Well, I wanted to keep the interview. I wanted to get it all before the camera. So I said, well, let's go up and put it on film. And he said, you know, William, he said, I would just as soon sit here and talk to you about it without having you film it. Now, I had told him, you know, that I'm writing this book, and I would like to come down and film and do this whole thing so I could have it for this oral history project. And so now he has said, you know, I'd just soon not have you film it. And I must have looked pretty crestfallen. When he looked at me, it seemed to be a century, but it was probably only about 10 seconds, and he said, left. And he said, all right, William, I'll do it for you. So I jumped up from the table and said, great, let's go do it. So I got him in the room, and I opened up the curtains, and I took the camera, and I set it up very quickly. And, you know, he said, my wife is he had told me, my wife is going to be back in about 45 minutes. So gone was my expectations of, you know, having the whole day with him, taking him to, you know, some nice spot in the French Quarter, having a nice lunch and having this leisurely conversation. Now I'm down to 45 minutes.
Right.
And so I know he doesn't want to be there. You can tell he doesn't want to be there. He doesn't know me from Adam, just from the phone. But for whatever reason, it's in him, and he does it. So I set the camera up. I turned it on. I prayed to God I had enough light, and I had a rough set of questions. And I just sat down, and I asked the question, got the answer. Now, I've developed a little bit of a style over the years where I try to take it real nice and real easy and start out real easy with people. I want them to get comfortable. I want them to understand I'm not there to abuse them. I'm not going to pull some fast one. I just want to talk to them like a person would talk to another person.
Right. So you take a little time and you say, well, you know, right. you talk about something that's even unrelated, and you just say,
right.
What did you think of the, let's just say you ate something at that restaurant. So what did you think of the restaurant, this kind of thing? You lay that groundwork, but you're pressed for time. You got 45 minutes.
I'm pressed for time. I've got 45 minutes, and I threw all that out the window, and I thought, all right, I'm just going to have to delve into it. So I would ask the question, get the answer, ask the question, get the answer, ask the question, get the answer. It was just that quick. And instead of the 45 minutes, he gave me 2 hours and 5 minutes.
Nice.
And, yeah, he looked at the autopsy photographs, and he said, well, I've seen him before. I said, well, would you look at him for me and give me your opinion? So he did that. And at one point, I'm sitting across this table from him, and he says, you know, when I saw the brain and I was handed this brain, he said, it looked like the carotid arteries at the bottom of the brain. He said it looked like they had constricted, like they had, you know, they had been cut for some time. And I said, well, what does that mean to you? And he said, I think that means to me, he says, I think, well, first he said Dr. Humes said he was standing next to Dr. Humes, and he was real close, and he heard Dr. Humes say, the damn thing fell out of my hand. Then he tells me about, you know, the artery thing. And I said, well, what does that all mean to you, Jim? And he said, well, what I think that means is that the brain was removed and then replaced. Well, you know, I'm sitting there, and to read something like that in a book is one thing. But to hear it from a guy that you're sitting feet across from in a little table, and he tells you this, I almost fell off my chair. I tried to act professional, and like, I hear this stuff all the time.
Right.
But inside I'm screaming. You know, it's like, this guy just told me that, you know, the brain was removed and then replaced. And so I did that interview. I offered to take him to Dallas, Texas. Back in the lobby, he introduced me briefly to his wife after this whole thing was over. And he said, no, I don't want to go to Texas. And with that, he turned, and him and his wife walked out of the room. I was under such pressure for that interview, and it turned out to be, I think, one of the best, if not the best, I'd ever done. And it absolutely left me convinced beyond any shadow of a doubt that President Kennedy had indeed died from a conspiracy.
Right. There's no other explanation. If there is all of this, you know, trouble with the medical evidence and manipulation of it one way or another, you have controversy over the x-rays. You have which is another thing we didn't even get into, by the way, because you happen to have had interaction with more than one person who was involved with the x-rays, you know, during the course of writing this book. And it's, you know, in the eye of history. But meanwhile, we're talking about the newer book right now. And it's just it's remarkable when you hear something like that. I mean, it's one thing. It's striking to read these things, like you said. But it's yet another thing to actually, you know, be in the midst of discussing it and get that information yourself. Right.
I'll tell you, it has led me down roads that I didn't think. It's gone way beyond
Before we do run out of time completely, okay, I do have one. We only got one live question in text form, so I want to ask it before we run out of time.
All right.
Since you had interviewed, you know, because they're quoting me about, you had interviewed a diverse array of people related to this particular narrow area of the case. Okay. And it is a narrow area of the case. You're talking about the body, the handling of it, and that is just one dimension here of the many areas that could be studied. But realistically, they want to know, actually, is there anybody that you regret not having gotten an interview with that you wanted, you know, for the book? Yeah.
Well, to begin with, when I went in to update the book, my my new publisher said he wanted to take things out. he wanted to be a certain length, and I'd already written like a couple hundred extra pages. And I said, this is a more well-rounded book. It has, you know, things from Parkland in it and things that the doctors have said. We didn't even get into my talking and interviewing Dr. Jones. Perhaps on another program we can get into that.
It
covers some ground that's been covered before, you know, things that happened in Parkland and Trauma Room 1 and Jack Ruby and how he acted after he shot Lee Oswald and the jailer that was guarding him, that sort of thing. I tried to give the Parkland part of it so that it could fit better in with not just Bethesda, but have Parkland and Bethesda, you know?
Well, it provides total context for the postmortem here, because you have the people in Parkland that saw one thing, and even Lipton did this, where he was comparing, you know, what did they see in Parkland versus what did they see in Bethesda, and you know, look, I'm kind of critical of Lipton, but I got to be honest with you, I appreciate that part of what he did. That is remarkable, and it's something that you're doing here. But again, you know, it's like, who is it that you wanted to get that you missed, you know, in one way or another?
Oh my Lord, there's so many. If I could have gotten interviews with Humes, Boswell, and Fink up until just recently, he passed, and I was searching for him. I'd heard through the grapevine that he was in Texas in a nursing facility. And if I could have found what nursing facility he was in, I would have went there and tried to get to him. But he passed before I could do that. Yeah. I was searching for Malcolm Perry when he died. This is kind of off the subject, but I found Cecil Stoughton. He wanted to do a book, and I heard this from somebody, and they had the information on him, and before I could talk to him about it, he had passed. There's so many. I was invited to do a documentary on Ted Sorensen. I've gotten into this. Has not only led me into books, but it's also led me into film, and I've produced, along with Mark Sobel, a film on RFK. We're working on it now. We've been working on it a good long time. And my next book, hopefully/maybe, will be the case on Robert Kennedy. But these people are passing. None of us are getting any younger. But you know, you have to do it as you have time and the finances, and people say yes to you. And it's all very difficult to put together. You can't do this at the drop of a hat. That's why it took me so long to get these people on the record.
Well, look,
I consider it an absolute miracle that I got the FBI agents on the record.
Oh, it is. Know? It is. But open invitation, by the way. Look, I'm more than happy when you're ready to discuss the RFK film. Absolutely come back on here. Let's talk about that. I mean, I don't know as much about the RFK case as I do about the JFK case, but I promise you, I would love to hear about that. I certainly want to hear about the other things that you're putting out and have put out. We didn't even discuss. We didn't even mention one of the other books here, but you know, it's. but yet you did say you're going to come back on. So
I did.
So we are definitely going to revisit this.
As far as I know, I'm the first person to ever do a book with one of the honor guard that took John F. Kennedy's burial casket to Arlington Cemetery.
Which is the book that I didn't even mention.
That's Betrayal, with Hugh Clark.
Right. And look, take a couple of minutes. Unfair. We'll have to get into it in the future. But take a couple of minutes. We did describe this concept of this joint forces group of individuals who would come together and be the honor guard to carry. And also, you know, the whole thing you see where people are firing weapons and the whole bit. If you've seen the footage of the funeral, these are the guys who do this. This is what they do. and all of that having been done at Arlington Cemetery. In fact, the first issue of your book, if I'm not mistaken, actually shows Kennedy's gravesite with the eternal flame. It's that sort of photograph is the cover.
Yes.
That was the copy that I got anyway. I want to say I got my copy in 2006, I think, seven, somewhere. Mm-hmm.
Available then, yeah.
It was just one of those things. I was really, really surprised. Honestly, I thought it was going to be terrible. Because I did.
Well, that always warms the heart of the author.
I really did, because so many people have done these things where they cherry pick little bits of interviews and they don't show you the context and they don't tell you how it happened and they don't. And it's like, okay, you know what, unless I can somehow get in touch with this author and get a hold of their tapes, I'm going to have no idea what the context of half of what this is. And it's so bad when they do that. Now, you take a look at in the eye of history, not an issue. And I've got to tell you, it's not just a good read, but it is also a remarkable reference piece. So, you know, there you go. There's the two key criteria. And again, you guys have heard me talk about how a book is interesting. It might be well written. There might be a couple of fascinating parts. I'll tell you sometimes, you know, this one chapter is worth your time. You hear that from me a lot. This is one of the books on the case that I can tell you is essential in your library. If you're getting into the details, look, you want a general overview, I'm not going to tell you to buy William Law's book. Okay, a general overview of the case. I really won't go there. I apologize to you, but unless you want to get into some details and you want to hear firsthand history from people that were involved in this very specific area, you might not enjoy it. You might be better off with Jim Douglas's book. But
Correct. You
want to know what actually happened with the body. You want to go through these things and hear from the people who participated in the X-rays, in the handling of the body, in the business of having things come in and out of Bethesda Naval Hospital, in the people who were, you know, obviously we talked about an illustrator here. We talked about, Sandra Spencer we didn't even touch on. I mentioned her quickly and then she was gone. Right. But who was Sandra Spencer real quick?
Sandra Spencer was a person at Anacostia Naval Developing Center there. She tells a tale that she was brought negatives, 4x5 negatives, by a Secret Service agent that was also part of the photography part of the Secret Service. He brought these negatives in while the funeral was going on, so very quickly, and she developed these negatives, not pictures, but negatives. And he said they had to adjust these things for color balance. And he said, it's okay to look at them, but don't peruse them. Don't look at them a long time. I just need you to develop these things. She had to look at them to make sure everything was balanced out. Right. So she tells the tale of going in and seeing these negatives. And in these negatives is a whole different set of images than we have of the president's body.
Which don't comport with either the Fox set of images, which are the legitimate leaked sort of pieces of the autopsy photography, or the descriptions of anybody who's actually gone into the National Archives and looked at the complete set. There are things missing that Sandra Spencer described, not only, I guess, to you, but also to other people over the years that are just simply not there now. What happened to these things? Good question. But there you go. The photography, the handling of the body, the X-rays, this is a very, very limited scope. But I'm telling you now, if you want to understand the way this was from the perspective of the people that participated, this is the book to get. I'm sorry I cut you off, but I want to make sure that I give you time at the very end here to sort of wrap things all together, and we can get in depth about any of these subjects. Guys, obviously, always, you know, send in your feedback. I will add your questions and anything you want to know about to future interviews. Mr. Law has been gracious enough to say he's going to come back. I'm sure that if you sent me 20 questions tomorrow and I had to sit here and go through them with him on a show next week or a couple of weeks from now, whatever, that he'd be more than willing to answer all of them. But We're kind of just about out of time. And here's the thing. Again, I endorse his work as I've seen it so far. And I have this feeling because you get to sort of know the style of an individual when you take a look at what it is they released. Sure, their publishers and sometimes their editors interfere with things a bit. But but realistically, you kind of get a good sense of who it is you're dealing with when you're taking a look at an author. And also just the limited amount of discussion I've had with you and observing your other interviews on other shows, I got to say that I know that you've taken a great deal of care with this. And there is a very serious part of preserving a piece of history that goes into William Mattson Law's work. So in the eye of history, I can absolutely endorse, even though I haven't seen the updated version, guarantee you it's worth it. And I love the original. I'm going to have my hands on an updated version shortly. When I do, I'm going to tell you guys about it. But also, there's other things that you're doing, like this new book, and we're going to obviously talk again before Lancer, which comes up in November, and also you're going to be at Judy's conference. But anyway,
that's right.
It is what it is. I'm not. We're gonna leave it at that. William Mattson Law. Here's the last thing that I'm gonna say is I'd love for you to sort of throw into people what it is you'd like them to take away from tonight's discussion, and I'm giving you about 60 seconds to work with.
What I'd like you to take away from this thing is, yes, it's a historical event. We're far enough away from the event itself that. Kids today, a lot of people might not even know who John F. Kennedy was. What I want you to take away from this is John F. Kennedy, a man lost his life in a Dallas street. We lost a president. Our nation suffered because of it. A family suffered because of it. It's caused ripples in this nation that still go today. We're still affected by it today, whether we realize it or not. And so I want you to realize that I do this because, yes, it's for history, but it's also because a guy lost his life, lost their husband, Jacqueline Kennedy lost her husband, the children lost their father. And that affects me. It's not a game to me. It's something I take really serious. Hopefully we will know all of the answers. I'm not hopeful about it, but I think we've come as close as we can given the knowledge that we have now. And I'm proud to say that I was just a little bit of a piece of that. But my research stands on everybody that ever went out and asked one of these witnesses a question. Anybody that ever wrote a book, I'm not the only one to do this. My research stands on the shoulders of a lot of people. I hope in the future that some of you sitting out there will do research and you'll stand on my shoulders. That's how this thing is going to get solved.
Well, absolutely. And look, here's the point that I make about the Kennedy assassination, because I'm often, you know, some people are very much, you know, interested, want to hear everything I do and every author I speak to about it. But some will tell me, listen, you know, this is ancient history. Why does this matter? So on and so forth. Here's my ultimate contention. If you can tell me that we would have engaged in the war in Vietnam in exactly the same way had not a man been executed publicly on November 22nd, 1963, in the streets of Dallas, if you can tell me that watershed event, which did a lot of damage to not only this country, you know, there's 58,000 names that we could read off, I guess, regarding the casualties, plus the more than 1 million individuals returned to this country damaged in one way or another, and let's not forget the Vietnamese people who, based on estimates, you could go between 1 and 3 million of them affected directly by it. Plus, you know, these people have families too. If you want to tell me that this is not something that is worthy of discussion, I don't know what to tell you. And, you know, I say again, this is my key reason for continuing on and on and on with this. And I think one thing that is deserved here is the truth as best we can find it. And there is no reason for national security to be the reason behind withholding any of this nonsense any longer. We should know, and all of it should see the light of day when it comes to the government. But also, I don't expect the government to tell us the truth. I expect us to have to find it on our own because, well, you know what? As someone who participates here in this country, you kind of got to work sometimes. And William Matson Law has definitely done that work again in the eye of history, but also at the cold shoulder of history. The book with Jim Jenkins, which we're going to talk more extensively about in a future show. But for now, we're all done. Again, I want to thank you, Mr. Law, for joining us. You know, this has been a pleasure. And as for you guys listening out there, remember this. Yeah, it's the O'Kelly Effect, but I am your Leo Kelly. All of you who listen, participate, ask questions, tell your friends about the show, whatever it is. You are indeed the effect. Have a good night.